Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Sly Kellett, your host, and it's getting real around here. Lots of meetings, lots of packing things up and moving them over to the hotel because our big national conference is tomorrow. Our 2020 national conference happens tomorrow. And it's a year late, but, you know, better late than never. So we're looking forward to seeing 600 or 700 of our best friends there. Theo comes to the conference virtually every time we have a conference, and in town a day early. Thanks for coming by the studio. It's always nice when people come by the studio before the actual conference. This hour and next, we've got 2 hours of open forum for you. 888-318-7884. Ask any question you want, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, whether you're a religious person or not, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Our guest for both hours is Joe Heschmeyer. Beloved apologist Joe Heschmeyer, now a Catholic Answers apologist, the author of Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis, the author of A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times, and other things. Hi, Joe Heschmeyer.
Hey, you know, since I always give you unhelpful advice, I thought I would give you a proposed 2020 conference slogan, given that we're doing it a year late.
Okay.
2020 is
hindsight. Joe, you know, before I got to know you really well, you used to limit yourself on the strange things you would say. But now I feel like a little regret that we're so comfortable around one another.
Just you, me, and like who knows how many people listen.
Because you say things like that. And I'm like, no, trust him. He's a really good apologist. But he just said that. No, he's smart, though. He's not good at jokes, but he's really smart. 888-318-7884, the number, 888-31-TRUTH. We'd love to have your call. You want to know something about the popes? Well, he wrote the book about the popes. You want to know something about the sacraments, maybe? You want to know about the person of Jesus or the Bible? 888-318-7884. You got a moral question? You got a philosophical question? It's all welcome. And you know what happened, Joe? Every single line already filled up. So I think we better take a few calls. Or would you like to do some more humor? If you'd like to do some more humor.
I'll try to work it into people's questions.
Subtly work in the humor. Okay. Yeah. Adam in Maryland listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for starting us off, Adam. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, is this me?
I don't know. Is it you, Adam?
Oh, okay.
It is? Okay, good. Yeah.
Sure right.
I didn't know if you were asking me or asking yourself.
It is me.
Joe wrote a book you might be interested in.
I don't know.
Joe, tell him the name of your book, the one that I didn't mention.
Who Am I, Lord? Finding Your Identity in Christ.
Who am I, Lord?
It does answer that question of who am I. So I don't know if that helps, Adam.
All right, Adam.
Oh, man, that would probably help me a lot. You know what? First off, thank you guys for your show. I'm 16 years old, and because of you guys, I've come back to my Catholic faith.
Oh, God bless
literally
you.
Literally, all my friends are Protestant, so I have a lot of questions to answer. But if my question is, if the Church is infallible and the Pope holds up infallible doctrines, how at any point in history could the church have even needed a little bit of reform? Like, how could the Pope have allowed the things like the Inquisitions and things like that?
Great. So I'm going to answer at the big level without getting into all of the historical details, if that's cool. Basically, like, even when God was leading the people of Israel, or when he was speaking directly to Moses, the people rebelled constantly. And so that bit of human rebellion is a pretty consistent thing throughout the history of the people of God, whether you're looking at the history of Israel or the history of the church. But the important details, if you look carefully at the history of the Catholic theology, all the ecumenical councils, and all of the different reform movements in the church, they're always about making the Catholic Church more Catholic, by making her more faithful to what she professes. They're never about making her less Catholic. Like, the Protestant Reformation was about making the church less Catholic, because they weren't just saying, hey, the problem is of bad Catholics. They were also saying the problem is good Catholics. The problem is Catholics who really believe what the Catholic Church teaches. That's the difference between how Catholics understand reform, that they're, you know, we don't always live up to our own standards. We don't always live up to our own ideals. And no pope perfectly executes the office in terms of, you know, making all the right decisions about who should be bishops, in terms of knowing how to intervene in tricky historical situations. Those kind of mistakes happen all the time, because human fallibility is totally consistent with what we believe about papal infallibility, that we still believe that as a man, the Pope makes a lot of mistakes, just like every bishop, priest, deacon, and layperson makes a lot of mistakes. Like, you and I make a lot of mistakes. We know, you know, you could also ask, like, well, if we know from the infallible scriptures what we ought to do, why don't we do them? And the answer is, well, because we still sin.
Okay, Adam?
Okay, yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, Adam, you're 16 years old and trying to answer these questions about the Catholic faith. I'd like to send you a couple books. I would like to send you Joe's book, Pope Peter, because your question fits with that. But we have this new book called Light from Darkness, Nine Times the Catholic Church Was in Turmoil and Came Out Stronger Than Before. It's from the very fine historian Steve Weidenkopf. And I think it'll give you a great deal of hope that these, when the church falls into these messes that we get into, the Holy Spirit always has a plan, not just to bring us back to where we were, but to a better place than we would have been otherwise. So if you want to hang on and give Thomas your information, we'll send you those two books, Pope Peter and Light from Darkness. And thanks for the call. It's very encouraging to start off with such kind words from you. Our number is 888-318-7884. Joe, there's the lines are still full. Unless you'd like to do some humor, I'm going to go to...
No, let's do it.
All right, Casey in Arlington, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Casey, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, if contraception is immoral for humans, is it also equally morally wrong to get our pets and animals spayed and neutered?
No, that's a great question. And it points to one of the things that, like, one of the mistakes. So a lot of population control people from, like, the mid-20th century would compare humans to, like, animals and just say, well, animals are overpopulated, so we just control their population. You know, I mean, in the most extreme situations, you have things like hunting seasons, or you have spaying and neutering. When we start to view humans as just animals, you see all sorts of really immoral things going on. You know, in the United States, for instance, we have a long kind of untold history of forcibly sterilizing people who we thought weren't fit to be members of our society. Just awful stuff. It was continuing until the 1970s in Puerto Rico, that when we treat humans like animals, there's something really grossly immoral about that. So it's not wrong to spay and neuter animals. It's not wrong, even in some cases, to kill and eat animals, because they don't have human dignity. Now, that doesn't mean we should show them no respect. There's a certain level, like, you don't want to be cruel. You don't want to, like, torture animals needlessly. But they don't possess the image of God in the way that humans do. And so we don't owe them the same kind of respect.
Casey, what do you think?
That's a great answer. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Great. Joe, you're getting high marks today. You're getting very high grades. I hope you do on your new Catholic Answers School of Apologetics course. It just came out today. You have a brand
new...
Did you notice that it came out?
I didn't. I knew it was coming out soon. I'm glad to hear it came out today.
Will you just say something about it? It's World Religions, a Snapshot. Why did you do a World Religions class for the Catholic Answer School of Apologetics?
You want to know the honest answer?
Because
I just finished teaching a class on World Religions. And I thought, if I'm ever going to do it, I should probably do it while I have these resources fresh, because otherwise I'm going to spend 6 months trying to find things I have at my fingertips. And I thought, like, you know, a lot of times when we're talking about apologetics, it's either Catholic, Protestant, or it's like Christian, atheist. But there's a whole world of people who don't fall into those categories. Muslims, Buddhists. I even touch briefly on like Mormons and just people who are going to be coming from a different perspective than either a Protestant or an atheist. So I don't claim that that's like an exhaustive, here's every single thing you would need to know. It's more like, here's some basic principles. And then in the last half or last third to half, going kind of point by point through a few different specific religions to say, here's a little bit about the history. Here's a little bit about what they believe. Here's some good questions to ask just to get you kind of off to the races.
Oh, wonderful. All right. So World Religions, a Snapshot is the new course from the Catholic Answer School of Apologetics today, because today is its introductory day. It's just $25 over at shop.catholic.com.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
If you have a few minutes a day, you can become an EWTN media missionary in your parish, in your community, or through prayer. Be a part of Mother Angelica's mission. Place your gifts and strengths in service to Christ and His church by volunteering your time and sharing the eternal word with the world. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today, a little bonus open forum. We almost always do open forum Tuesdays and Thursdays, but every now and then we just get the itch to add a little extra open forum in. And Joe Heschmeyer was kind enough to do 2 hours of it with us today, and then he's going to get on an airplane and come to San Diego and be one of the featured speakers at our big Catholic Answers National Conference. But you can call right now and ask me anything you want, 888-318-7884. I'm going to go down to Costa Rica now, watching on Facebook, Heichel in Costa Rica. And Heichel, I believe that we've spoken before, have we not? Okay. All right, good.
I'm not sure if those have that direct relation.
Those are really good questions. So for people who don't know, Luke 11:52 is when Jesus talks about, I used to get this line quoted to me all the time when I was a lawyer. It's when he says, "Woe to you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourself, and you've hindered those who were entering." And then in Matthew 23, we have similar kind of language when he says, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees." And then he talks about them closing the gates of heaven. So in both of those cases, key seems to be in reference to kind of the knowledge and authority that they have. So specifically in Matthew 23, the beginning of it, back in verse 2, it says that the scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean literally Moses has a chair and, you know, the scribes and Pharisees like take turns sitting in the chair. The seat is a symbol of authority. In Latin, the word is cathedra. That's where we get the word cathedral. or if you talk about a papal statement ex cathedra, like from the chair, and the chair is the symbol of authority, the seat of power, so to speak. So the scribes and Pharisees have inherited this Mosaic authority. And so he says in verse 3, practice and observe whatever they tell you, but not what they do, for they preach but do not practice. So I think that's a good sense. Like, you should be mindful of the way he's using these references to the keys to say two things. Number one, that we should listen to the people who have the keys, and we listen to the people who sit in the seat. Like, we listen to the people who have that legitimate authority. And number two, we should listen to them even though they may not be personally holy, or we may not agree with every decision they make, or we may not like the way they don't practice what they preach. That what they preach can still be protected even if they're not practicing it themselves. All of that is kind of a backdrop for understanding the gift of the keys to the kingdom of heaven to St. Peter in Matthew 16, that it shows that there is a real imparting of authority in a way that would have made sense to first century Jews. In my book, Pope Peter, I point out that, like, if you find out what binding and loosening means to an ancient Jewish reader, you can look at the Jewish Encyclopedia. It has a whole entry on binding and loosening. And the idea was that the Sanhedrin and the high priest, in certain contexts, could infallibly decide certain questions of morality. So, for instance, you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. Well, how far are you allowed to walk? How much are you allowed to do? You know, those kind of questions. How heavy a load could you pick up? The authorities had to make decisions on that. And the idea was that God would respect those decisions because someone has to say, here's how we turn that principle into a livable rule of life. Because otherwise, one person may say, well, I'm not working that hard. And someone else is like afraid to get out of bed because that feels like too much work. That you need some sort of way of making it, you know, actually livable. That was an idea that the Jews understood. It's an idea that Christians understand. It's one of the reasons why both the Pope and the church more broadly have the ability to bind and to loosen. So I think that's a good, those are two good verses to look to see kind of the backdrop in which these words are uttered.
Okay, Heiko?
Oh, okay, great.
Right?
Yeah, right. Great.
Great. Well, thanks for calling. I'm glad we don't get that many calls from Costa Rica, so I'm glad we hear from you from time to time.
Thank you very much. Have a pretty good afternoon.
You too. Thank you. Our number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, and it's open to anyone, whether you agree with us or disagree with us, whether you're Catholic or not a Catholic, Christian or not a Christian. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, about Catholic people, Catholic practices, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We go down to Houston, Texas now. Martha, listening on Guadalupe Radio, you are up next, Martha. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Oh, we're happy to have you.
Every morning, well, thank you. Every morning when I go to work, I drive to work and I'm saying my rosary and I'm listening to an app on the radio, and at the end they always say the litany of the Blessed Virgin. So my question is this: what is the origin of Tower of David, Tower of Ivory, and House of Gold?
Yeah, fortunately for me, St. John Henry Newman has a series of like devotional like reflections that he gives, and he looks at each of these. So in terms of the Tower of David, you know, the idea of a tower is like a strong bulwark against the enemy. And so why do we call Mary a Tower of David? Well, because she's of the line of David. Why a Tower of Ivory? It's a symbol of beauty. Well, why is she called a tower? Well, because when all the apostles crumble, Mary stands, and she's still standing at the foot of the cross. That there's this sense that, like, she is so animated by faith, she's so solid in her faith, that she is like a tower. But then the other image you talked about is the house of gold. Well, gold is this idea of house of gold is a biblical image. We see, for instance, in the book of Revelation, the descriptions of the New Jerusalem being covered in gold. Gold is a symbol of being precious and also being pure because gold is purified in fire. And so Mary is both precious and pure. And so that's why we describe her as gold. And then house of gold, There's a whole backdrop of the messianic prophecies of the prophet Ezekiel. The last eight chapters of the book of Ezekiel talk about a house, like a temple that is to come. And it's pretty clearly a reference to Jesus. I mean, not it's not clear at the time, but later, like in the light of the New Testament, it becomes clear that rather than being an actual prophecy of a literal building, this was instead a series of prophecies about Jesus Christ. But around the temple is a temple gate in Ezekiel 44 that is often compared to Mary. The Lord himself is described as passing through the gate, and then it's closed to everyone else. And so this idea of describing Mary as a house or a temple of the Lord and being a golden one is rooted in scriptural stuff, but it's devotional language of trying to find kind of new, maybe poetic ways of expressing what we've always believed.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for taking my call. That I really enjoy the program because although I would probably not be able to regurgitate all the explanations, and I'm learning so much from the radio.
You know, that's Martha, thank you for saying that. I often feel the same way myself. I mean, a lot of the times these shows kind of come at you, there'll be technical questions and hard questions, and I get the same thing. Like sometimes I feel like, well, I probably couldn't repeat everything Jimmy just said or Joe just said, but that I have a general idea now. I leave with a good confidence that I have the sense of the answer.
You know, could I add something to that?
Yeah.
I don't actually think you need all the technical stuff. Like I think it's fun to get to explore the maybe infrequently asked questions, shall we say. You know, when someone says, here's an off-the-wall thing I've never known the answer to. But in terms of sharing with other people, I think being able to share your own witness is the most effective. If you just say, here's what Jesus did in my life, and you're the only expert on that, you know, like if you can witness to that, that does more to convert people than I think knowing, you know, the origins of Tower of David and House of Gold or any other kind of arcane knowledge.
Martha, thanks again. I'm going to keep moving, try to get folks on before we have to go to our next break. So we'll go to Oregon. Don in Oregon, watching on YouTube. Don, you there with us?
Yeah, thank you. So I am a Catholic, and I'm not asking this because I doubt the truth of the teaching. I just have a hard time understanding and explaining it. It has to do with meriting salvation when we're in a state of grace, and it almost seems kind of redundant because we're already part of the family of God. So then in what way are they saying, would Jesus say, yes, now you're now going to be part of the family of God because you've done these good works, but I already was in the family of God when I was doing those good works. Does that make sense?
It does. And you're using the right image for it in describing a family. Like there's certain things you have to do as part of a family, and they don't really earn your way into the family. You know what I mean? Like if you've got kids and you've got a list of chores that the kids have to do, it isn't like some stranger could come along and say, well, I checked off this list. Now I deserve to be here. That's not what we mean by merit. But you could still say someone is really like one of your kids has really like earned their place in the family, so to speak, because they're really taking seriously their what's owed as a son or a daughter. So I don't know if that image helps, but it's a way of trying to capture a technical distinction that's sometimes called condign and congruent merit. And that's a really like fancy pants way of saying there's strict merit. Like I literally just earned this. That would be like the stranger doing the list of chores and then being owed sonship, which is wrong. We don't strictly merit in regards to God. But the other kind is this semi-merit, where we can talk about merit, but it isn't owed in justice. And so we can think of some real examples of this outside of the realm of theology, things like employee of the month. If you get named employee of the month, did you earn it? Well, in one sense, yes. You did your job. You did it really well. But it isn't like if someone else wins Employee of the Month, you can like turn around and sue because you feel like you were owed it more than they were. You're not owed it in justice, but it's still owed in one sense as an acknowledgement of the works that you've done. Is that distinction making sense? I want to add to it, but I want to make sure we're tracking kind of so far.
Well, yeah, I'm on board with the condign merit versus the strict merit. It's the redundancy element that I'm sort of having trouble understanding. It's like there's a sense in which I'm already saved. So how will you say like I've earned like an additional I know it's not an additional salvation. It's like I'm already in grace. I'm already in a right relationship with you. I'm already justified. I'm already saved. So in what way now do my good works, like, merit salvation since I'm already saved?
Right. They don't merit in the sense of moving us from unsaved to saved. Initial justification is purely gratuitous on the part of God. So it's actually, this is, and you're capturing a real irony. It's only the person who is in a state of being saved who can merit in any sort of meaningful sense. And we're still not talking about merit in the strict sense. So the idea is that whereas many Protestant theologies will take something called forensic justification, the idea that God just declares us righteous, the Catholic view is that God, through grace, actually makes us righteous, but that we have a role to play in that, not in terms of saving ourselves apart from God, but in actually cooperating with our salvation as an ongoing process. Because it isn't like, well, I got saved last week, so I'm just going to let everything go. You still have to work to maintain it. So likewise, you know, you had nothing to do with your birth. You were a passive recipient of that. But now that you are alive, now that you have to do a lot of things to maintain staying alive. And so there's one sense in which you are responsible for the fact you're still alive. If you'd totally failed to eat, if you'd like done some risky thing that killed you, you wouldn't be. So we can talk in one loose kind of sense that, yeah, it's owing to you that you're alive. In another sense, it's not. And so when we're talking about salvation, it's the same thing. Like, it's owing to you in one sense that you're alive in Christ. You've continued to say yes to him. You've responded to the impulses he's placed on your heart through the Spirit. But there's another sense in which you're really the recipient of an action that you couldn't have initiated yourself.
And we got to leave it there, Don, because the music is playing. We'll take a quick break and be back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer. If you're on the line, hang on. We're just going to take quick 60 or 90 seconds or something. We'll do a few things and we'll come back and get to your call. And if you haven't called but you've got a question, there are a couple lines open. 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Open Forum. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Hi, this is Johnnet Williams. We bring you the truth of the Catholic faith on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and it's open forum. And we love questions about the Catholic faith. maybe you got kind of a complaint about the Catholic faith or something you think, nah, that doesn't make any sense, or something you'd like to correct us on, it's all welcome. We just love talking about the Catholic faith. Whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. There are moral teaching you'd like to talk about, maybe one of the sacramental teachings of the church, maybe a doctrine of the church. Maybe it's something we do you'd like to talk about. 888-318-7884. We're going to go to Mounds, Oklahoma now. Lisa in Mounds, Oklahoma, listening on the EWTN app. We're delighted to have you, Lisa. Well, I said we're delighted to have you, but then Lisa dropped. That I think Lisa was not delighted to have. No, I'm not. I'm sure that it was a coincidence. Call back, Lisa, though, if you want to ask that question. We'd love to take your call. Let's go to Jim in Bismarck, North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. I'm going to click the button really fast before you can hang up. Jim, go ahead with your question. Seriously? Really? It's going to be this kind of day with Joe? Jim in Bismarck, North Dakota. All right. I'm just going to... Joe, we're going to get to play a game called... Jim.
My question is...
Oh, hi.
Can you
Do we lose him? Okay.
We've got a little breaky connection here on my end.
Oh, that's okay. Try it again. Just give us your question, and we'll do our very best to get an answer to you.
Okay. The question is, what is non-incarnational processism? What does that mean as compared to the Catholic understanding of the incarnation and the non-incarnational Protestant thought?
Are you thinking of non-denominational Protestantism, possibly? Or are you talking specifically about people who deny the incarnation?
I think you're going to have to try with non-incarnational, Joe, because... Is what he said. Yeah, you know what?
I'm sorry.
We're breaking up too much. I'm going to put him on hold.
Saying, Jim.
But he can hear your answer, Joe. So what do you know about non-incarnational Protestantism? Never heard of it?
So I'm inclined to think it might be a reference to non-denominational Protestantism, which is pretty popular. And often it'll be people who have, broadly speaking, what we would call Baptist theology. But they are a little less organized even than Baptists, whereas like Baptists are part of like, you know, the Southern Baptist Conference or some other group of Baptists. Non-denominational Christians tend to want to be even free of that because they were trying to be free of any kind of denomination, thinking that, well, this is the way that we can have greater Christian unity. The result, ironically, is that it's mostly resulted in just forming another denomination. But the impulse is not a bad one. We should try to have non-denominational Christianity. And I would say the Catholic Church is a church and not a denomination and is the answer for what they're looking for there.
I was just going to say, maybe pose another theory to you, like Unitarianism or Jehovah's Witnesses. These are forms of Protestant religion. I won't say Christianity, but they... that do not believe that Christ is God incarnate.
Yeah, that's what I was going to go next. Like the other possibility is that he means some much more kind of fringe views that really say Jesus is not God in the flesh. But then to really drill into what they do believe depends on, well, you know, are we looking at Jehovah's Witnesses? Are we looking at Unitarians? Are we looking at like Baha'i? And none of those I think I would really call Protestant.
Yeah, right.
Just because... usually we use Protestant to refer to Trinitarian Christians who reject the traditional churches of Christendom.
I'm going to have to leave it there, Jim. I'm sorry that we're the second day in a row. We're having some kind of phone troubles and some folks can't hear us and got little delays here and there. We're going to just can soldier on, do the best we can. But I'm sorry we weren't able to have more of a conversation to kind of get at where you were going, Jim. I'm going to go to Violet here in California, watching on YouTube. Violet, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're well.
Thank you.
My question is, you're welcome. I'm calling because as I was looking at the questionnaire for a nullification process for matrimony, I noticed that some of the questions are very intimate. It asks about even the wedding night and some very deep questions about the other half, so to speak. Some of the information I don't have, and it's difficult to find, especially for someone in my situation who's been through a domestic violence situation. Why isn't there a different process to go through? Because this brings up a lot of turmoil. That was kind of my question. Why so deep?
Yeah. Violet, first of all, please accept my heartfelt just sorrow for what you've gone through. That sounds like an awful, awful experience. In terms of like why we ask those kind of personal questions, the idea is pretty straightforward. Jesus says that if you're truly married, like if God makes the two one, man can't separate that. And so when we're looking at a question of whether a marriage is valid or null, we're trying to figure out what are the signs that this really is an authentic marriage. In other words, if you're like forced into a marriage against your will, you're not bound to that. Or if someone is psychologically in a place where they can't consent, you're not bound, you know, like you couldn't even consent to a contract if you're under those kind of situations. God's not holding you bound to that. So what we're trying to figure out is basically, did God join these two people together or not? And that is inherently a very intimate kind of question. Like, you're dealing with this incredibly intimate thing of marriage. And especially given that the way that marriage is consummated is ordinarily the wedding night, they have to ask some questions about that. I'll give you some examples. There was a conference in Rome, and they were looking at some of the sort of strange cases that can come up here. And so, for instance, there was a couple that they got in a fight at the wedding reception. And they never consummated their marriage, but they'd engaged in premarital relationships. And so the question was, is their marriage bound? Did they consummate the marriage? And the answer was no, because they never did it in the way that God had kind of laid out. So those kind of questions, the only way to find out if those kind of cases exist, unfortunately, is to ask. Now, the last thing I should say, just because you shared a little bit about domestic violence, in saying this, whether there is a marriage in the eyes of God or not, you are never under any kind of obligation to stay in a situation that is unsafe to you or your children. So regardless of the nullification process, you have both the right and in some cases even the moral duty to get out of a situation like domestic violence. So don't let those kind of procedural questions get in the way of saying, you know, you have a duty and charity to take care of yourself and any children that you may have. Does that help?
Hang on. Let me get Violet back on the line. Violet, does that help you?
Yes, it does help. We did not have children, but and I am very safe. But I'm just for putting it out there for people, this actually has happened a long time ago, and I'm barely going through the nullification process because I want to reclaim my Catholic faith, and I want to be one with God and hopefully remarry one day in the correct way, you know. But lastly, I just want to thank you for that answer. But I do still wish there was a different process, because there's some questions on there as well, not just intimate. But I understand there's some, like, I have to get some kind of letters or some kind of declaration from people that knew us in the marriage. And because of the situation, how it was, I very much cut out a lot of people from during that time for my safety. And I live in a different way, and my social circle has changed.
That's not your world anymore.
In part for my safety. It's not. We had our world. Don't share that world. He's even remarried because he was not Catholic to begin with. So he's remarried and made his life, which is fine. But I just wish there was a little less heavy of a process.
Violet, is there anybody at the parish who can help you through this process? Often the deacon in the parish is well-versed in the kind of tribunal, the ways of the tribunal. Is there anybody that's helping you?
I reached out to the priest at the parish, but it was just kind of like, well, you answer this, and this is a formal case, and it requires attention and paperwork, and it was just kind of procedural.
I would share a little bit of what you just shared, because I think any priest or deacon who knows what they're doing, even if they don't know canon law, can put you in touch with the diocese canon lawyer, because the diocese has multiple canon lawyers, and they can tell you, well, in these kind of cases where it would be impractical or maybe even unsafe to go contacting people from the past, yeah, we can, you know, a lot of time there are ways around some of the, I can't get into the minutia, but I would just say, don't assume, right. But in a situation like that, I bet there's a little more wiggle room on what you actually have to provide and what you don't. But a canon lawyer would be much better qualified to speak to the details.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I appreciate the time, and thank you.
Okay, God bless you, Violet. Thanks. Call back if you have any more questions. Our number is 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and you're welcome to call with any question you've got. 888-318-7884. Lots of people getting back to Mass. You know, it depends on where you are around the world. In some places, it's been a long, long time, and people just getting back. Some folks have been back for a while, but if you're in that process and you'd like a really beautiful reflection on ways to prepare for communion each Sunday when you go to Mass, we have a brand new free ebook for you. It's called 5 Ways to Prepare for Communion by our own Father Hugh Barber. You can download your free copy at shop.catholic.com.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour and next. And you are welcome to call with any question at all. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic people, Catholic practice, whether you're Catholic or not, we'd love to talk with you. 888-318-7884. Going to Cincinnati, Julian, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for your call, Julian. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the call. Thanks for taking my call today. So sure. Here's my question. So we believe, the Catholic Church believes that when you go to hell, you burn forever, right? And what kind of God do you think we are serving that would put people in hell to burn forever? And how about those people who are in heaven? Do they have any memory of the ones that's burning in hell? So, for instance, I believe that when you go to hell, you burn up and you're done. It's like taking a piece of paper, putting it in fire. It's burnt up, and it's burnt up forever. It will never be a paper again. Couldn't that be what the? Couldn't it be that when the Bible says that you are burnt up forever, means that you no longer exist in any form? You're done.
Good questions. I want to pick apart each of the questions, if I may. So first, it's not really so much that God sends people to hell. It's more that God respects people who refuse heaven. what I mean is this, and like I can't stress this enough because this really is the Christian message, that God desires all men to be saved. We're told that explicitly in the New Testament. And the way he reaches out to people is totally unique and personal. Like from the outside, it might look to us like someone else has just been abandoned by God, but that's never true. And oftentimes you'll see, if you follow the story of the person long enough, you'll see some incredible conversion, or you'll see some sign that no, God isn't done with this person. God hasn't abandoned them. He's actually doing something in their life. There are other times where God's doing all sorts of things in their life and they're saying no, and we can't see that from the outside. So I would just say, it's not that God doesn't care about people. We're told quite the opposite. He goes to the lengths of the cross to save people. But there is still this sense wherein we can freely say no to the offer of salvation. And so, you know, if the only thing that'll ever make my heart happy eternally is God, and I say no to God, it's not coherent to then complain that I'm not happy, because I can never be happy with anything other than God. That's the first part. The second part is, you know, do people in heaven know about the people in hell? And the answer to that seems to be yes. For instance, in the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus tells about Lazarus and the rich man, it's a parable, but it gives us some sense that there's some kind of awareness. And of course, if they're in the presence of the all-knowing God, they're not like lacking information about the world or information about like the nature of reality. And then finally, like this question of, well, maybe they're just burnt up and annihilated. The church has never believed that they're just annihilated, because scripture doesn't say that. It talks about, you know, eternal fire, and which again shouldn't be understood as literal, but should be understood as speaking to something true nevertheless. C.S. Lewis gives an image that stops short of annihilation, but it's similar to what you said with the paper. He compares it to like a log that burns up in the fire. There's a certain point in which it's no longer very recognizable as a log. It still is what it was before, but all the good parts have kind of burnt off. And so in that sense, when we think about like souls of people we love potentially going to hell, you know, God forbid, but should that happen, it's not like they're going to be their great old self in hell. It's going to be minus all of those parts that were redeemable, so to speak. They'd be unrecognizable in that sense, just kind of a husk of who they were before, because all of the ways in which even now God is at work in their lives, you wouldn't be seeing that for someone in hell. That makes sense?
To an extent, the first question was great. But here is the thing. What does the Bible mean then when it says that Sodom and Gomorrah suffered eternal fire? And Sodom and Gomorrah is not burning today, isn't it?
No. Which part are you talking about Sodom and Gomorrah suffering eternal fire? Is there a particular verse you have?
There is a text that talks about that Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a New Testament verse. It said it was destroyed with eternal fire. Yeah.
Yes, Jude 1, verse 7. I'm sorry about that.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, it doesn't mean there the historical destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It means whatever they're currently undergoing, seemingly. It says they serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire, which seems like there's a sense in which the destruction has not ceased. And so the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is often tied to the Dead Sea, which stays dead. But I understand where you're coming from with that. But the idea is that these are spiritual beings. So one of the clearest references is in Matthew 25, verse 41, where Jesus is talking about the last judgment, and he says that those on his left, he'll say, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." Well, that's an important reference, because the devil and his angels are spiritual beings. They don't have a natural death the way that a material being does. So it makes sense that the fire is eternal. We have eternal souls. Like, we have a spiritual soul, you know, that don't die in the way our bodies do. And so it makes sense that the fire is eternal in that sense as well.
All right. Okay. I'm going to leave it there, Julian. All right. Thank you very, very much for the call. Richard in South Carolina watching on YouTube. You are next. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Okay. My question is, how can you ask the saints for intercession if there's no guarantee they're in heaven? And could you be asking someone to pray for you that's in hell?
That's a really good question. Two-part answer. If they're canonized saints, we believe we have certainty that they're in heaven. That, you know, the church has looked at this question. And one of the reasons why there's a process of canonization is so we're not wasting our time asking for prayers for someone who can't respond to that and wouldn't respond to that if they could. A similar thing would be if I ask my neighbor to pray for me, I'm assuming my neighbor's in right relationship with God, but maybe they're not. And, you know, it talks about the, you know, God not hearing the prayers of the unrighteous, whereas the prayers of the righteous are efficacious in Scripture. And so maybe they're not going to be very effective at praying for me. Maybe they're going to get my request and not pray for me at all. That doesn't stop me from asking my neighbor for prayers. So it doesn't stop me from asking those who've gone before us for prayers as well. Worst case scenario, nothing happens. Like, worst case scenario, they just don't pray because they're not in a spot to pray for us. Does that help?
Yep.
Okay, very good. I'm just trying to be patient with each caller because we have a little bit of a delay on the phone line. So I'm just waiting for folks' response because I don't know where it's. I don't know. I think the satellite is turned a little to the left or maybe a little to the right, and the connection is not quite being made. Let's go to Tommy in Knoxville, Tennessee, listening on iHeart Radio. Tommy, thanks very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Si.
Hi, Tommy.
Joe, I want to follow up with you on a question you had earlier, or I'm sorry, a response to a caller, and it's about consummating the marriage. And I thought you said if you didn't consummate on your wedding night, the marriage was not valid. Is that correct, or did I misinterpret that?
It's not consummated. It's not indissoluble. And if you want the technical term, it's ratified but not consummated. Ratum sed non consummatum. That's the way canon law refers to it. That the first stage of a Christian wedding is the wedding ceremony, and the second stage is the two becoming one flesh. Obviously, you only like celebrate the one publicly. The other is intimate, but it is the natural end of marriage. It's what marriage is about.
Okay. Well, like if you don't say you don't make love on your wedding night and you do it a different night, is the marriage still legit?
Oh yeah, sure. So it's legit either way. But the question is in something like a divorce. It doesn't have to be on the wedding night. Like I use the wedding night just kind of as a euphemism for having marital relations. Whenever that is, whether that's you know a week after your wedding, whether it's you know in between the wedding and the reception, wherever. That's what completes what's begun in the wedding. If you, and there are some weird cases where like that doesn't happen. You know, for instance, St. Therese of Lisieux's parents waited like 9 months and their priest had to really encourage them to take that next step. There are some other cases. I think St. John of Capistrano was originally married and actually had his marriage dissolved because he'd never consummated it. A lot of royal weddings where it was done for more political reasons than anything like love. There would often be issues with them not wanting to consummate just because they didn't like each other. Catherine of Aragorn, this was the whole issue with Henry VIII, whether or not she'd ever consummated the marriage with her prior husband. Those kinds of questions are rare, but they do come up. And the basic idea is that if you've contractually married, but if the two haven't become one flesh, we can dissolve a contract. So a non-consummated marriage we can dissolve. It's still a valid marriage in one sense, but it hasn't been consummated. When the consummation happens from the book of Genesis onwards, we have this sense that the two become one. That's something that's happening at a divine level that we're not free to dissolve on our own.
All right, Tommy. I think we're still having phone trouble, so I'm going to leave it there. Tommy, thanks very much for the call. Hey, Joe's going to stay for another hour, so if you want to call, go ahead and call 888-318-7884. We've got a few lines open. If you're on the line, stay on the line. We're going to get to you. 888-318-7884. Joe, we're coming nearer and nearer the end of the year of St. Joseph, and I keep thinking, at least here at Catholic Answers on the air, you know, we've talked about St. Joseph and all that. We just... I feel like maybe we haven't honored St. Joseph enough. So will you just give us a little rundown of what you wrote in your book and why St. Joseph is important to you? I'd really appreciate it if you would do that.
Yeah, sure. So I wrote a book called A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And I wanted to say, like, what is it that Joseph actually has to offer us? And so I explore a little bit, this dovetails really nicely on the last question I just got about the two stages of a Catholic wedding. Because I explore the two stages of a Jewish wedding. And Jewish weddings worked a little differently than our weddings do today. And so when you hear in Scripture, in Matthew 1 and Luke 1, there's some confusing stuff where sometimes it looks like Mary and Joseph are just engaged, but then other times Joseph has called her husband and said he's contemplating divorce. So if you've ever looked at all that and said, I don't know what's going on, there's all sorts of questions like that that I explore to show what Joseph has to say for husbands and fathers and for Christian disciples of all kinds.
We got to take a quick break, Joe. We'll be right back. Lots and lots of folks calling. Not exactly sure what's going on with the phone lines. The calls are coming in and then just dropping right away. So we'll try to fix that during the break. I'm pretty sure it's probably Thomas's fault. We usually find a way to make it Thomas's fault, even if it's not his. So we'll see about that. But give us a call, 888-318-7884. We continue with Open Forum and Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
This is Kevin O'Brien of EWTN's Theater of the Word. I'm excited also to teach middle school and high school literature, speech, and drama with homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. Your student can meet with me online for a live, interactive class. Whether you take apologetics with John Martinoni or grade school with Jackie De La Viaga or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, online Catholic learning for your homeschooling family is available for you.